Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So you may remember, I think it was back in April, actually, when U.S. intelligence officials came out and said, you know, China is going to be a massive security threat. In fact, the word that they used was unparalleled. They are an unparalleled security threat because, well, you know, they've got our manufacturing base. They've figured out how to infiltrate probably all of our computers because we need the chips from them and all of the stuff that's come over here. And they're getting much more, well, much more aggressive with their military. And this is kind of one of these moments where, is it too late already? I'm kind of concerned that it is, especially how weird and screwed up we are right now. But yesterday was a good day. The Senate, actually, in a bipartisan way, said we need to do something on the Chinese, on the China front. We need to do something about our manufacturing. And they finally passed a piece of legislation that is going to help. It's called the U.S. Innovation and Competition Act, focused on, hey, making us more competitive. The Chinese not happy. And here to share some thoughts on why the Chinese aren't happy, I've asked our good friend Emily Delaburie to come talk with us. Emily is the co-founder of the Horizon Advisory, their website, horizonadvisory.org. Emily, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you for having me.
So let's get right to the piece of legislation. Yesterday, 68-32 vote. You had 19 Republicans come along and say, yeah, we got to do something on the China front. We've got to invest in U.S. manufacturing of semiconductors, of rare earth materials. We got to figure out how to deal with. We need a manufacturing base. I'll tell you, kind of stunned.
I mean, the issue that there's bipartisan agreement on is China. This is fantastic, right? Because it means that suddenly this is something that's tractable, that there's going to be every incentive to work on. And also, like, that the reality isn't going away anytime soon, that we're in a structural competition and a determinative competition with China. And also now there's political pressure on both sides to keep towing this line. I'm not going to pretend I think this bill is sufficient or perfect, but the fact that it exists and that both sides are willing to put their weight behind something like this, that's fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, the numbers are, you know, it's a pretty sizable bill. But when you start talking about $50 billion over a decade, it sounds like a big number, but it's really not. When you talk about, we've basically lost our manufacturing capability of semiconductors. And then you think about how important they are to our daily lives. I mean, I look around my studio and, you know, there's probably hundreds, if not a thousand of them right here where I'm at.
Yeah, and actually, this is a question I have for you. When you look at this bill, do you think that there's enough for the manufacturing of semiconductors, for example, or manufacturing broadly, as opposed to like basic research and development into them?
No, I don't think there's enough for manufacturing. We have spent the last two decades allowing corporate America to move our manufacturing base overseas for pure greed, for pure profit, for cheap labor and lax environmental regulations, which I've said for years is heroin to CEOs. They can't get enough of that fix. But now we're starting to look at it as a number of us have been saying over the years, this is a national security risk. The reason we were able to win World War II is we were able to compete by building ourselves into it. The battlefront of this generation is internet, it's technology, it's cybersecurity, it's all of this stuff, and we are woefully behind.
Yeah, that makes sense. And like, that's my big concern about this bill, is that we're continuing to put our resources into like the early stage research and development and not the applications and not the industry and the industrial capacity, you know, which to my mind risks just like further fueling a system that's not working instead of changing it.
Right.
However, you know, that doesn't change the fact that this bill in its own right is a great step.
No, I mean, for me, and maybe you'll come along, we're at a Manhattan Project kind of moment. We are so far behind, and this is such an important issue. Semiconductors and information technology and cybersecurity, we should be spending massively on it. Not just, you know, $50 billion is a lot of money, but it's not near enough.
Yes. And I'd like for the next, you know, the next tranche of money that goes into this, like the next step is to say, okay, you know, because what this does, right, is kind of just like adds more resources to what already exists in terms of like the stages we focus on. I want the next version of this to say, okay, those test beds, those research and development test beds we gave like initial sums to in this first bill, those are going to get more funding because what matters is actually building the stuff. And instead of giving money to like developing new technologies for critical minerals, we're going to put money into the actual mining and production of those minerals and processing of them. And same in semiconductors. Like I want us with every step of putting the resources we need into this to move farther down the industry chain so that we're actually able to capture the applications, which is where we're losing the race, not just, you know, continue to win at the basic innovation, but have that be stolen by China. And have China win the race that matters.
No, and make sure that we have the capability of getting the factors of production as well. The fact that we're reliant on the Chinese for rare earth minerals and things that we need to do this is kind of frightening, because at the end of the day, and I know the Chinese came out today and said, well, you know what they did yesterday was Cold War thinking and, you know, zero sum thinking. But they've been looking at this in a war footing for a very long time. It's only us who, no, we're friends. We're partners. As long as we're giving them things, yeah, we're buddies. But the second we say, no, I'm not giving them my lunch money anymore, now it's Cold War era thinking.
Yes, exactly. And just going to the early state, the first beat there, it doesn't really matter if we know how to make the production factors. If we're the best at knowing how to produce them, if we're not the ones producing them. And I think we're starting to realize that, but that's, the flip that, the switch that's going to flip, I think that's how that phrase works. And that's what I'm looking forward to next.
Now, I've had these conversations for years now on how the Chinese use these state-owned corporations they just funnel tons of money into it. And they basically can sell finished product and develop things for, even cheaper than we can buy the raw materials for, simply to take over the market and to dominate whatever sector that they've targeted. For me, this is kind of that moment where in a bipartisan way, you have politicians, again, on both sides of the aisle, 19 Republicans came along and put aside their ideology of free markets and all of that nonsense to say, look, we've got to make a stand. I think this is an incredible and an important moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And also I'd add, like, the industries they focus on are the industries that matter. Like, they identified the right candidates. And I'll leave aside my issues with how precisely resources were allocated, but the bill talks about standards, which are incredibly important, technical standards, and China's effort to game them. It does talk about protecting intellectual property and protecting U.S. research and development, and it acknowledges the role of manufacturing, even if, there's a lot of work left. Yes, like, everything this bill stands for is precisely right.
It's just not enough in my view. Now, one of the things they do talk about is something we've talked about a number of times, this 5G technology, the next generation of cell, of, internet, whatever. We're woefully behind. And if you listen to the woman in Ohio, it's the 5G technology and the vaccine who have made us all magnetic, which is kind of funny in a certain way. But the sad reality is, and who knows, maybe the Chinese have figured out a way to put the vaccine in us and make it, maybe she's right and we just don't know it.
Yeah, in that case, we're due for a rude awakening, but we can't do anything about it. And I mean, I do think that, like, the 5G point, though, that gets to, and I'm going to keep hammering on this, but like, what has to come next? This bill isn't going to be enough for making us competitive on 5G. What's going to make us competitive on 5G is investing in large scale infrastructure so that is built at, the 5G necessary telecommunications networks are built out across the country, and also competing for the international technical standards in 5G and all the way across the industry chain. And that's something that doesn't come from this bill. It comes from an infrastructure bill, and it comes from a manufacturing focus bill. And it comes from understanding that supply chains are broad and that standards are a competitive domain.
No, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was saying, but we've made a first step. I'll be happy about that for now. Let's hope we make the next five steps we need.
No, and then that's it. You've got to make the next five steps because, I think if anything, the pandemic, again, has awakened some folks. I've had people who were the China cheerleaders for a while, now going, well, maybe you were right, you know, kind of the head down. Maybe they're not our allies in all of this. Maybe they are our competitors. And look, we don't have to take a war kind of verbiage. We'll say they're aggressive competitors, even though I say, look, we're in the middle of a war. It's a new generation kind of war. It's a new type of war, but we're still at war with these people. And the disinformation that they're throwing out, and the fact, you know, they had a bunch of op-eds dropped today. They had a bunch of stuff coming out saying, no, we're not that bad. You know, please don't make us the invisible enemy, I think the one guy said. No, you're not invisible. We know exactly who you are.
And it's just so amazing. Like, their propaganda machine, their disinformation machine is so good. Because domestically, for decades, as you said, they've been saying this is a war. You know, the U.S. is our adversary. We're going to overtake the U.S. We're going to reshape the global system, what have you. But they're so good at turning on a dime the second we do anything competitive and saying, oh, my goodness, you're going to cause confrontation. It's not the Cold War. Don't make us your adversary. And that, they're right, because that targets a really clear sensitivity within, you know, U.S. thinking. We're so bad at competing. We so hate confrontation that we see that. And the immediate reaction is to take a step back and say, oh my goodness, we have to just de-escalate. We shouldn't cause a war.
Yeah.
But the thing is, like, we're already in one. So it's either we surrender or we realize that we got to compete and their propaganda is nonsense.
No, I'm right there with you. So let me ask you this, because, you know, and this is, you know, to bring it back home. I'm looking around and I'm feeling despair. I'm almost feeling to the point where it's almost hopeless. When you look at how divided we are as a country, where we can't seem to agree on very much, and we're literally eating ourselves from within. This China issue could be something that we can rally around and unite around. Maybe we'll see. But I have this kind of despair in that I don't know. I don't know that we're up to the challenge. In this moment in history, we're not my grandparents' generation who rose to their challenge. I don't know that we can.
And it's really remarkable because the China issue has all the ingredients to cause us to come together on this subject. And, you know, of course, like, their propaganda machine gets in the way. But for example, everything that polarizes people in the US about the US is worse in China. Whether you're coming at it from the question of human rights or environmental degradation or rule of law abuses, or from the other direction in terms of the national security angle, you point at China and they're a whole lot worse. But we're so inclined to turn inside, you know, to turn inwardly and, you know, hate the US or hate ourselves or hate our neighbor that we don't realize how bad this threat actually is, and how terrible their authoritarian regime and what a threat to ours it constitutes.
Yeah. And to highlight your point on their propaganda machine, there was a letter to the editor in the New York Times, I'm sure, or the Los Angeles Times, I'm sure you saw this, by a guy named Zhang Ping. He is the consul general of the People's Republic of China there in Los Angeles. And he was talking about the LA Times had come out and said that they supported the boycott of products made with cotton that was produced by the Uyghurs and people who they said were put into the forced labor. And they came out and said, you know, there's, you know, he claims that the Times embraced the rhetoric of, how did he put it, the rhetoric of genocide and forced labor. And he said, there's never been genocide in Zhejiang, I guess, or forced labor in the region's cotton fields or any other sector. It just never happened. We don't do genocide. We don't do forced labor. We're good people. We know that this is false.
Yeah. And also, let's just talk about that asymmetry there. Can you imagine a Chinese media outlet running commentary from somebody in the US talking about the genocide in Xinjiang? It just wouldn't happen because they protect that. And yet we're going to run that letter from the editor because freedom of press, because all voices should be out there. And so they're able to force their narrative into any conversation and give it outsized presence, which then lets it catch on and makes people think that they can reasonably argue or suggest that maybe the genocide in Xinjiang doesn't exist. It does.
Yeah, there's no question. But, you know, and I go back to where I said a minute ago, I have some despair about us being able to rise to this moment's challenge. And look, I don't have a problem with the Chinese people. I have a problem with the Chinese government. I have a problem with their leaders. I have a problem with the thing, their mercantilist policies. I have a problem with all that. But with the Chinese people, I want them to lead good lives. I want them to be treated well. But I'm telling you, I have some hope because I saw a story today that the 20-somethings in China are saying, we're not going the 9-9-12 route, or what is it, the 9-9-6 route. You work 9 in the morning and 9 at night, 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. We're not doing this. We're not working ourselves to death. And they're doing this lying flat thing that's going on in protest. And this gives me some hope that maybe there's an opportunity to change things there at some point. Or am I being too optimistic?
I mean, okay, let's acknowledge, first of all, that I'm never going to be the optimist in the group.
Okay.
That said, I mean, I think that there are, and I'm always inclined to dismiss those things that we say are inevitable and inevitably going to support, you know, the U.S. moving forward, because I don't want us to take those things for granted. But I think, A, it's certainly valid that no matter what effort China makes fully to repress information, it will not be repressed. And, you know, people, young people in China are going to receive a message about the rest of the world. That still leaves it up to, in large part, us and allies and partners to make that narrative a compelling one, not to make it so easy to paint, you know, us as a fallen empire with shootings at every corner and, you know, economic prospects dwindling, but rather as a place of freedom and self-expression that should appeal to a 20-something. So, you know, we need to work on that. But the idea that information is going to reach there and that can change the hearts and minds of young people in China, that's a really valid one. The other, you know, what you just said prompted in my head as well. We have this conventional wisdom that the U.S. private sector is going to save us. And, you know, there are many reasons to say that's not going to happen. But a couple of things this week have been, you know, have made me a little more optimistic on that front. Peloton's building a factory in the U.S. First Solar is building a factory in Ohio to make, you know, solar panels or inputs for solar panels. These are really good things. And maybe the narrative about China and about the need to produce in America actually is having an impact on the private sector. And that, you know, that there, like just those two things strike me as tremendous progress and a sign that maybe hope is not entirely lost.
Or they're seeing that there's a lot of money to be made off of what's coming. And it's purely about the greed that got us into this mess. Because corporate America put us here. I fear the idea that corporate America is going to get us out. But Emily, I appreciate the time. I appreciate your input and your expertise. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Good stuff. As always, our good friend Emily Delabrue. Make sure you check out their website, horizonadvisory.org. We'll get some links out on how you can take a look at that. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.